Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Hi, welcome to Business Game Changers. Today I have an amazing interview lined up with Wallace Thornhill of the Electric Universe and the Thunderbolts Project. He is the chief science advisor for that organization, and I got to tell you, this was a very fascinating interview that I did. I learned a lot, and he is going to be talking about the upcoming conference that's in August. It starts August 17th, and he's going to be talking about all sorts of interesting things. He's going to be talking about the fact that the Electric Universe points to a hollow Earth. He's going to be talking about what the origins of Earth is, and Mars very easily could have had life just like ours, and he's going to be talking about that. Very fascinating. I think this is the Electric Universe is, no matter where you think, whether you're a hardcore skeptic or whether you're starting to believe it, whether you're learning, I think this needs to be debated and get out there. A lot of all of their theories are proving out in the labs. And the recent thing in Jupiter, he's going to talk about NASA's probe Juno that went out to Jupiter and what it found and how NASA was surprised by a lot of the results. But the Electric Universe theory, actually it works, and it supports the theory even more. And he's going to talk about what they found and why it supports the theory. A lot of really interesting information. So let's get into that interview now with Wallace Thornhill.
Hi, Wallace. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for the invitation again, Sarah.
Yeah, I love having you here. You're expanding our minds and getting us to think about a new way of looking at this. Something that I think will help people if they really look into it. But let's talk about your conference that you have going on. You have a conference coming up in August. What do you hope people walk away with from that conference?
Well, one of the things that happens at those conferences is that people become inspired because it's a multidisciplinary effort, this new cosmology. People can see things that they're interested in that they could actually pursue looking at it from a new perspective. And some of the speakers that we have this year and in previous years have been those people that have been inspired and then wanted to participate. And that has been very gratifying, because this work is just, it's enormous, and there's just too much for an individual to do. I realized that decades ago, and when I teamed up with David Talbot. So it's really gratifying to see people, the energy at the conference. And I think because it's a completely new way of looking at ourselves, not just the universe, but ourselves, that there's that different energy, and people come back year after year. And this year, each year it gets better as a result, because they talk to other people and get them to come along. And this year looks like being even more people coming than last year. So
it's a really growing movement, isn't it? And people are very professional. People are starting to really take notice and take this seriously.
Yes. And I think that's the other gratifying thing, is that the people who are speaking, a lot of them are professionals. And this was always the way I thought this would happen, because when you're making a paradigm shift of the magnitude that this is, it requires a lot of digestion and also courage to join us, because, of course, the establishment, if we can call them that, are not very happy at having their very comfortable world disrupted to the extent that this new paradigm is sure to do. So when we get professionals joining us, I'm very grateful, because it shows great courage and also commitment to finding the real answers.
Well, I think this is a great time in history, because so many things are disrupting so many things. So the whole notion of disruption is starting to be just is more accepted. I mean, it's still not accepted, obviously, but I think we're seeing many more people with courage coming forward and saying, okay, this particular thing didn't work, and what you're saying makes sense to me, and I will at least look into it.
Yes, that's the critical thing. Skepticism is healthy when it's used in that fashion. In other words, you look at all of the evidence and then try and weigh it up yourself to decide which is the more plausible and the one that should be investigated further. We have a lot of noise and flack from skeptics, and those people who label themselves as skeptics show that they have a problem, because it really is a kind of a religious approach to science, one that will not accept any divergence from the scriptures, so to speak. And we can see this. Even some of the skeptics like Michael Shermer in the Scientific American are perfect examples of this. I don't waste my time now, because time is precious, and there's so much more to be learnt with these people. But those who have joined us have been willing to take up the argument to the public to try and get them to see which is the more plausible, the standard approach, the Big Bang Theory and all of that kind of nonsense, and the practical one that we're putting forward, which is very attractive to engineers and the practical people, the ones who have to make things work. That also is a good indication, I think, that we're on the right track.
Well, and I don't see why there's so much pushback to at least look into it and have an open mind and to start debating. I think that's our problem. We have so many issues, and until we can open our mind and actually debate things, we're just not going to move forward. But I want to talk a little bit about what you're speaking about at the conference, because you, of course, are the featured speaker. Can you discuss what you are going to be talking about?
Yes, this conference is the first time that we will be acknowledging the inspiration that many of us got from Emanuel Velikovsky back in 1950 when he published that book, Worlds in Collision. So we have one day devoted to that. And I will be speaking there about Velikovsky's astrophysics, because he was the one who put me on the path to trying to understand the real nature of gravity, because the hostility towards him from astronomers came from the fact that he demonstrated that if he was right, and he had assembled a formidable amount of evidence in favor of his ideas, but it was all, it could be dismissed as being, it's just myth and legend and you don't have to worry about it, despite the fact that humanity seemed to be desperate for us to learn something, but we just class it as myth and therefore not worth considering. So the astronomers stood on their dignity and said, this disobeys Newton's law, so it's all rubbish, we'll have the book burned. And that's what happened. The technical publisher was forced to remainder and burn their copies and hand it over to a popular publisher. So history just repeats itself. And having lived long enough to see what's happening, I believe that that is so once again. When you get to the point of a big paradigm shift, like, you know, the Earth is not the center of the universe and that we actually revolve around the sun, that paradigm shift took an awful lot of digesting by those who believed the old story. The same is going to happen again, because Velikovsky's challenge was just dismissed, but it was the same magnitude of, or even more so, because it said that the solar system can actually be chaotic at times. And this is a challenge to our desire for peace and tranquility and certainty. That was one of the challenges that I wanted to take up when I actually visited Velikovsky, was to understand what it is we don't understand about gravity. I mean, that's one of the most important things to know. It's the thing that holds us to the Earth. All we have is mathematics. Neither Newton nor Einstein actually explained it. They just described it in different ways. And we still are floundering with a cosmology which relies on gravity as the central theme of how the universe works. But if you don't understand it, then the chances are you're seriously wrong in the conclusions that you draw from your observations.
Well, there's the difference between what's going on now and what happened in Velikovsky's days. You are really putting science behind all this. Not that he didn't put science, but you're really putting formulas and mathematics and testing it in laboratories. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, before I do that, I should just say I have two sessions to give at the conference. The other one is on future science, and that looks at what the future is likely to hold when the electric universe model is accepted. Because it has huge implications for everything, even to the psychology of humankind. We, you know, if the solar system was disordered in the past, then you can see that the whole human race suffers what you could term post-traumatic stress disorder, and we need help, you know, globally. The whole of humanity, and you can see that because of our insane behavior towards the planet and to each other. The electric universe is one which shows a connectedness of all things, and I think this is essential for our long-term survival. So the two things is recovery from post-traumatic stress disorder and an understanding of our essential connectedness.
So we're connected at a base level electrically.
It's at a level which I think the natural therapist would call subtle energies. It's the same kind of thing as gravity itself. Gravity, if you like, is the subtle energy that holds the solar system and runs it like clockwork. But you've got to understand gravity before you can understand this connection. It is a connection between matter. I mean, we know that if you have two lumps of lead, they are attracted to each other. Well, why? The question is why? Well, it's this same attraction which actually exists at the biological level as well. And I think this will be addressed at our conference by some of our speakers, new speakers. To getting back to your other question, which I diverted from, if you could just repeat the question, I'll just try and answer that one.
Well, you were bringing up Velikovsky and how he wasn't accepted in his day, because he was the first person to really have a different way of thinking about it and coming up with answers for all these patterns that he was seeing in, you know, scriptures and myths in from all different types of, you know, civilizations. But you're now taking those concepts and putting science behind it, in the sense of he had science too, but you're actually testing things out in laboratories, and you're looking at phenomena now and testing it against these theories. Can you talk about that a little? Because that's the crux of what I think people are starting to really flock to this.
Yes. There have been a number of scientists involved who sadly have passed on, but I worked with them. I took inspiration from them as well in this quest to try and understand how to explain using physics the things that Velikovsky had laid or made clear that happened in the past. And out of that, I mean, it's had to address everything. Our understanding of matter interactions, which comes down to the level of particle physics, right up to the cosmic level and the understanding of stars and how they're formed and galaxies and so on. So it encompasses everything. The great part of it has been that it does take time to overcome all of the things that you believe from your training, from your childhood at school and at university. And they are the big stumbling blocks, because when you come up against them, you think people are going to think I'm crazy when I say this. And we'll come on an example of that later in perhaps. But one of them, of course, was Einstein. Einstein's theory of gravity and of relativity really doesn't make sense when you come down to fundamental physics. You cannot have rubbery measuring sticks. You cannot have rubbery clocks, you know, that run faster or slower depending on how you look at them. Physics depends on accurate measurements and a standard. And Einstein more or less removed the standards and made them arbitrary so that, sure, you can verify Einstein's equations by just changing your perspective. But it's all a perspective thing.
So you choose the way everything is working, the reason why equations are working is because the things that should be standard are fluctuating all the time, so that it's kind of a catch-all kind of deal.
Yes. In fact, we've got to the ridiculous situation now where the meter is defined in terms of the speed of light. In other words, we've, by fiat, if you like, made the speed of light a universal constant. And because they found it varying, they decided to make the meter, define the meter in terms of the speed of light. Well, that's a circular argument. It's just incorrect. And the same goes for the measurement of time. Einstein kept talking about clocks, but they're physical objects and they're physical mechanisms. It's got nothing to do with time. So you can mess with your clocks, and of course this is what happens. You put clocks up into orbit and we use them for GPS. The engineers never bothered with Einstein. They just set the counters in their timing, their clocks on the satellites, to count a different number of ticks because they tick at a different rate in orbit. And this comes down to an understanding of energy. And do you know that physics does not have a definition of energy in terms of matter? All they do is they talk about conservation of energy and how it can be transformed from one form to another, but there's no mention of what it actually is. You cannot define it in Einstein's terms because he's removed the standard of measurements.
How would you define it?
Energy is matter in motion with respect to all other matter in the universe, which gets back to classical physics and Marx's principle and so on. But this relies on the information about the existence of matter in one part of the universe and another part of the universe has to be practically instantaneous. If there's any speed of light delay, then you've got incoherence and a universe that won't work. So you get back to what the great scientists at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century were actually doing, and that was real physics, and it suddenly went off the rails back in 1927, where at the Solvay conference, where you had Niels Bohr and Einstein put on pedestals, and it's more or less stagnated ever since.
Well, it's interesting that there's a lot of fields that have stagnated around that time.
That's exactly right, because the basic science just isn't there. Technology can advance because whatever you discover in the laboratory, you can then apply technologically. And of course, the technology then assists the discovery of new things, and so on it goes. And so technology has grown at a great pace over the past century. And the scientists have sort of said, oh, look, this is all down to us. No, it's not. You haven't actually explained a lot of this. And therefore, whatever you produce with your technology, you're treating us as lab rats. You know, you're testing these things on us because you don't understand what you're doing. And we see a lot of this now coming out in the epidemics of behavioral disorders, attention disorders. This is in both the medical and the, particularly the medical and the food industry side of things, because they're just, whatever works, they'll try on us without telling us quite often. And the same goes for radiation sensitivity. A lot of people now are sensitive to high-frequency radiation they're bathed in every day. And there's no understanding of this on the part of engineers because the science is lacking. Well, now, the electric universe provides the basis for understanding these things. And once that happens, technologies then, I mean, a technologist, an engineer can look at the basic physical model of what's going on and say, oh, I think I can develop that and build an anti-gravity machine, or I can develop that and figure out how to build a device which can actually tune into you and find out what's going on, causing you problems, instead of all this machinery and chemical interference.
Well, our whole way of looking at the world will change, but also the speed at which we come up with solutions that can really help will probably be accelerated, put it.
Yeah, they talk about quantum leaps. This will be the quantum leap to end all quantum leaps, because we will actually have a physical understanding, a better physical understanding of ourselves and our place in the universe.
Well, there's been some exciting events that have occurred recently around Jupiter. And it has allowed you to solidify again with even more information the electric universe concept. NASA scientists have been puzzled by their latest observations because it contradicts their theories and, you know, the standard theories. But there are no problems for the electric universe model. Can you tell us about this and how? I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yes, it is, but it wasn't surprising. There are two problems. One is the idea or the fairy story about how planets formed around the sun. That's just a children's tale. It's got nothing to do with reality. And so the story of how Jupiter formed and what it's composed of and constructed and how it's constructed are mere stories. And the belief was, before Juno got to Jupiter, that Jupiter would be boring. In other words, it would be fairly uniform throughout. And they said that they would have three means of measuring what's going on. One is a radiometer for the atmosphere. The other one was magnetism, which goes deeper. And the third one was gravity. Well, neither magnetism nor gravity are understood physically. I mean, we have equations which describe what happens, but we don't understand what's going on at the atomic and the subatomic level to generate a magnetic field or to generate a gravitational field. So when the results came back, I was delighted because it more or less confirmed that this was the case. Jupiter is not boring. There's things going on there that they don't understand. Those cyclones at the north and south poles of Jupiter. Of course, relying on the Juno information alone was not sufficient to understand Jupiter. The funny thing is that discordant data is often forgotten quickly. Now, there was a natural probe of Jupiter's atmosphere only a few decades ago when Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacted Jupiter. And they saw those unexpected bright flashes and powerful auroras and so on. And the puzzles then were never really answered. So what I did in a recent YouTube video, the three-parter actually, because there was so much to cover on the atmosphere, was that the Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 encounter with Jupiter was an electrical phenomenon first and foremost, not just an impact. And so most of the strange things that happened can easily be explained from the electrical point of view. And so the first part of those three YouTube videos on the thunderbolts.info website covered the electrical aspect of those storms and so on. The second one looked at the formation of Jupiter and the fact that both stars in the electric universe model, it's been discovered that stars form along strings in molecular clouds. Now, gravity can't do that, but electricity can, and electric discharge can. It's a natural outcome, rather like ball lightning, bead lightning, where you get little beads formed along a powerful lightning channel. But it's not just stars that are formed then, it's also planets, which makes sense. I mean, why use different means of producing the bodies, the solid bodies and the gaseous bodies in the universe? That means that when that's finished and the stars and the planets are formed along this string, the nearest ones will form partnerships. So you'll get all of these weird exoplanetary systems with so-called hot Jupiters and so on, which shouldn't actually be so close to a star, according to the standard theory. They just attract one another and form these weird and wonderful exoplanetary systems. And there's thousands of them that have been discovered now, and very few of them look like the solar system. Having so many bodies formed in close proximity also means that after the event, long after the event, there will be cold bodies, brown dwarfs that you can hardly see because they're only just glowing, will be captured also at later times. I might say the capture is far more likely in the electric universe model of gravity because it actually works in order to try and capture and form systems. So Jupiter's birth story is quite different. It was captured by the sun. It wasn't had nothing to do with the sun originally, and that's why all of the outer planets are such a fruit salad. They're all so different. They were all captured.
Well, are there a lot more planets then everywhere that we just haven't identified yet that's in our solar system?
Yes, I would say so. Mm.
Well, I saw a YouTube video on that, and they were pointing at a whole bunch more planets.
Yes.
But nobody's really come forward to officially to talk about it.
Yes. The interesting thing is that a large planet in interplanetary space is independent of our sun's electrical environment, so that the tendency for those objects is to actually light up as brown dwarfs. So there's no difference between a star and a planet, in other words, just their sizes. And when they get to a certain size, they exhibit all of the features of a star. And there are good electrical reasons for that.
Is the sun incredibly hot then, or is... Because they have, I've seen some videos, and I don't even know if these are real, but they're of things that are moving and then go to the sun, pull something out of it, and then leave as if they're taking energy out of the sun. And it was like, well, if it's that hot, how could anything even get close to it? But Go ahead.
It's only between 5,000 and 6,000 degrees, the photosphere. And, beneath the photosphere, when you see through a sunspot, it's cooler inside. So the actual body of the sun is cool. And this is also a feature of the electrical formation of stars and planets. The material that's attracted to that filament is actually cool. It's not hot, and it doesn't form a hot star. And it doesn't form it doesn't have any of the qualities necessary to generate nuclear fusion in the core. So that a star is an electrical phenomenon first and foremost, although the electrical activity is sufficient to cause nuclear reactions in the photosphere. I mean, we've discovered neutrinos coming from the sun, which means that there are nuclear reactions taking place there. It's just assumed they come from the core.
Interesting. But, I've talked to electrical engineers that say that the solar flares are that take out all of our electric systems and things. Those are all electrical flares.
Yes, they are. They're electrical currents which actually impinge on the Earth and cause sudden changes in our electrical environment, which is reflected on the ground at the ground level in surges and power lines and so on. And the evidence for electrical activity in space is enormous, but it's ignored. You won't find any reference in the index of an encyclopedia or an astronomical text to deal with electricity in space. Of course, the physicists will say, "Oh, yeah, but you know, we know that there's electrical effects," but then they blame it on magnetism. But magnetism is a second order effect of the electric force. I would say that the electric universe was deliberately named because in the electric universe model, you only need a single force to explain magnetism and gravity and the nuclear force. You don't need to invent forces just to patch up your equations.
Things are cleaner.
They're cleaner. They're simpler. This was the way that science was done in the 18th and 19th century. It was an attempt to simplify. Unfortunately, since Einstein and Niels Bohr and that, when physics became statistical and so on and unrelated to physical reality, we lost all that. So the history of science will have to be eventually rewritten by the winners, and it'll look completely different to the one that's being taught now to students. the heroes will be different. And you can see that a lot of these ideas have been discovered, forgotten, and I don't claim priority in many things because they're the work of others, the real pioneers of the science of the future.
And their work is all there. It just needs to be rediscovered.
It needs to be rediscovered. But students these days are forced to concentrate on what's happened in the last few years. And the history they're taught is really, once again, a kind of fairy story. It's it's been concocted by the winners, so to speak, to make people feel good.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Velikovsky's theories proved out again in Electric Universe proved out again when they went to Venus. The same thing.
Yes.
That was the.
That's one of the critical aspects of Velikovsky's work was that he made outrageous predictions, which were poo-pooed at the time by all the experts, but were later found to be correct. And of course, then it was just a sheer accident that he'd predicted them, but it wasn't. It was predicted on the basis of his reconstruction of what the ancients saw in the sky. So it had a sound basis, and also he almost made no mistakes. You know, he said there would be remnant magnetism to be found in the moon rocks, but then didn't bother to photograph and check the orientation of the rocks that were brought back. So that was a surprise, and next time they collected anything, they had to check the orientation so that when they got back to Earth, they could learn something about the moon's magnetism. His most outrageous prediction was that Venus was incandescent within the memory of mankind. They witnessed it. And at the time, the idea of astronomers was that the average temperature there should, under those very thick clouds and heavy atmosphere, should be about 17 degrees Celsius. Well, it was first thought when Mariner 2 went past, it was 600 degrees Celsius. And then a few years later, when the landers went, they said, oops, no, it's 800 degrees. In other words, hot enough to melt some metals. Velikovsky was right. He also predicted radio noises from Jupiter because the thunderbolts of the gods refer to Jupiter's thunderbolt. Well, you don't get thunderbolts without electricity and radio noise. So it was a perfectly reasonable prediction based on his reconstruction. But none of this credited to him.
And weren't some of the planets closer to the Earth?
Well, that's what the ancients... the reconstruction that David Talbot did following Velikovsky's inspiration is much more detailed. Both he and Eduardo Cardona did an amazing job, and it really required having a completely open mind about what they were discovering and not trying to force any preconceptions on it. And that's important in science. That's one of the critical things, not to force your preconceptions on what you expect to find. And it took Dave Talbot, and I understand this completely, some years to actually accept what he'd found, because the description of what was seen meant that it almost looked like the laws of physics didn't apply. But no, it was a case, after I'd examined it myself for decades, that we just didn't understand the laws of physics. we should always remain humble about the extent of our learning, because it doesn't matter how far you go, you find the mysteries still recede into the distance. You know, the mysteries are deeper or more distant, but at least when you cross certain hurdles, many things become clearer.
Well, those are the answers to why human race has amnesia, as people say it, and why there were a lot of mass catastrophes in the past, mass extinctions, mass has to do with what you're learning.
Yes, the geological record is unequivocal that there were mass extinctions in the past. And with the present understanding of gravity, of course, this is due to impacts. when gravity as an attractive force is all you've got to work with, all you've got are explosions and collisions, as somebody once said, which is a pretty limited toolbox. However, the history of the Earth is far more interesting and dramatic than anything we've ever been taught. And the changes in the flora and fauna on the Earth were quite dramatic after some of these catastrophes, which means the environment had changed dramatically. It wasn't just an impact where and then everything sort of settled down after a few million years and we were roughly where we were before in the solar system and so on. It's nothing like that. The changes were dramatic. We've
For
also
example,
found...
What would you say would be the change? How can you explain that a little bit, how what that means, the dramatic change? Like, what could it have been before?
I hesitate to say this, but we are a captured satellite of the sun as well. And it was, and before that, we were a partner to one of these brown dwarf stars. Now, brown dwarfs have a bad habit of flaring. That means that they can be putting out their heat at several hundred degrees, which is quite nice if you're a close satellite of such a body. But occasionally they'll suddenly brighten and throw off material with great gusto. This is a bit of a mystery to astronomers because they're supposed to be dying stars or stars that didn't quite make it. But in the electrical model, it's all perfectly understandable. And that would mean that the nearby satellites, like the Earth, would be showered with material. There would be changes in the electrical environment, which would change the gravity. Now, we know that dinosaurs can't exist in, or couldn't exist in today's environment, in present-day gravity. They wouldn't be able to lift themselves off the ground. So the changes are far more dramatic than any impact scenario or volcanic scenario. All of these things, volcanoes and so on, are more or less secondary effects. And the fact that almost every body that's been examined close up in the solar system is stratified, has layers. Mars has huge layering discovered in the walls of Velis Marineris. The moon was found to have layers. These layers can be laid down in that environment where you've got a star that occasionally sheds material. And, of course, the animals died and they were buried, and they were buried quickly, instantly almost. So all of these things fit a scenario which has nothing to do with impact, but has to do with the total environment.
It explains what we're finding, like those huge skeletons or animals that were solidified as a rock immediately.
Yes, there's many anomalies in fossils that can't be explained by simple impacts or anything like that. Also, the very fact that the flora of the Earth changed. We had tropical zones with, you know, in the Arctic and so on. None of this makes any sense unless the environment was dramatically different.
Well, and that's what they think is in Antarctica. They think that it was tropical.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And that's they've shown.
Yeah, Eduardo Cardona has done the most complete research on the former Earth environment in a series of huge tomes. I've got one in front of me here. It's about 2 inches thick, and it's a letter-sized book. So anyone who's interested in the primordial understanding of Earth's history, I really recommend his books. Unfortunately, Dwight died recently, unfortunately, but this is the problem, of course, for all of us pioneers. We all have our time to try and provide a new way of looking at things as quickly as we can before we have to hand over to somebody else.
Well, maybe you can get that aging technology that's starting to come forward, which is
I'm doing my best.
Well, the other thing with Mars, Mars has, they think that there's some evidence now of life that existed on Mars. You know, people are talking about that all the time, but it's coming forward from the establishment as well. Now, could Mars have been in a completely different environment as well, and then all of their life went away instantaneously, just like we've had to.
Yeah, we have a lot of information about that, which is not recognized by planetary scientists. In fact, it's so far off their map that they'd probably have difficulty in even reading it. The ancients had a lot to say about Mars, because Mars apparently was a very close neighbor of the Earth during some of these events, and the ancients witnessed Mars up close and personal. In fact, Mars was called Scarface by the North American Indians, and of course legends about him having been injured in battle are found in the classics. So the reconstruction has Mars a partner in the same system. Earth and Mars are in the same brown dwarf system. So the conditions on Mars were probably the same, pretty much like the Earth's. And the chances of life being there were very high, in my opinion. However, the ancients witnessed the battles, as they call them, of Mars. I mean, Mars was the god of war. Well, poor old Mars apparently suffered dreadfully in that battle. And Dave Talbot has a very good YouTube video, almost a feature-length one, on the battle-scarred Mars. And you realize that the chances of finding fossil records and so on Mars are not too good, because it's had kilometers of material ripped off its northern hemisphere. This is why the hemispheres look so different. And that giant gash that runs a third of the way around the planet, of course, was the one witnessed by the ancients, it seems, and the reference to Scarface. So the scientists are right. The problem they've got is that they have tried to apply the same kind of thinking and ideas that infect Earth geology and applied it to Mars. And they've given it various epochs, like the Amazonian and so on, geological epochs, as if that explains anything. It doesn't. No, the history of Mars was dramatic, and it was rather unfortunate. I understand what the problem was electrically and why it was so badly battered. But it also has reference to Venus, because Venus was involved as well.
Do they think life existed on Mars when they witnessed all that stuff?
Oh, well, the ancients, of course, had no idea, really, of what they were seeing.
Sure.
All they could do was describe it and terms that they understood. Yes, I think I understand quite well what happened.
But do you think that there was life on Mars at that point when everything, the catastrophe happened?
My best guess is yes, and it could have been quite as advanced as anything on Earth.
Interesting. Oh, that's a horrible to think about. They It must have been very traumatic for people to watch a whole planet being ripped apart.
Yes, and I think this is where some of our PTSD comes from, because we thought we were in next in line.
Well, this is a big bombshell thing here. Another concept you brought forward is that by understanding gravity, it seems Jupiter is hollow, and that Earth, Moon, and all large celestial bodies are hollow as well. Now, have you come forward and talked about this before? And
No, I've sort of hinted at it.
Okay, so I want to hear about it, and why do you think it's all? Because it explains all these stories all over the place as well.
Well, I'm not the first one to think of it. It's got a history going back several hundred years of some scientists, too, who felt that the hollow Earth model had to be considered. Unfortunately, the standard view of how gravity works doesn't allow for it, obviously. But I've shown in many YouTube videos, which people can see on the thunderbolts.info website, that gravity is essentially an electrical force, and it's one that Velikovsky hinted at when I visited him, but he was looking at the atomic level, and that doesn't work, and I knew that didn't work. But a clue was given to me only 2 years later in 1981 by a tiny advertisement in the Scientific American by an American, and he was publishing a tiny journal called the Journal of Classical Physics. And of course, when it said classical physics, my eyes lit up, but then it had the title of the first article, and it was called Electron Structure. Now, that was the key. All subatomic particles, according to this model that this fellow produced, have an orbital system of smaller particles. So it's like the atom is repeated inside the particles inside the atom. And that that was the key, because he could then describe magnetism in terms of the this tiny little electric dipoles, because atoms in an electric field distort. They form a football shape. One end is positive where the nucleus is closer, and the other end is negative. So it's like a little electric dipole, like a magnet. And he showed that if you run an electric current through a wire, what it's doing is distorting the electrons transversely. They end up, the footballs are all aligned transverse to the current. And if you have two parallel wires, they're lined up in such a way they attract one another. And he produced Ampere's law based on that simple model. And I thought, well, that's a very good start. He then went on to say that you could understand gravity in the same way. And I've painted the simple picture. You imagine an atom has 2,000 to 4,000 times the mass of the electrons that are floating around. So most of the mass of the atom is in the nucleus. So in a gravitational field, because you can't shield gravity, the nucleus is pulled down towards the center of the Earth. But that means the one end of the atom is positive and the other end is negative, and there's an electric field inside the atom. That electric field will distort the particles inside the atom, in the nucleus and so on. And it's that tiny distortion which is the gravitational field, because you can't shield it. It daisy chains through electrons, protons, whatever, whether it's a gas or liquid or metal or non-metal. And so this answers that question, why you can't shield gravity. And it also answers that puzzle, which is still puzzles scientists, is why is gravity so weak? You know, it's 1,000 billion times weaker than the pure electric force. Well, the reason is the distortion in those subatomic particles is minuscule. But this raises a problem. That means that the entire outside of a body like the Earth has all of the negative poles facing outwards. All the poles in the moon are negative facing outwards. That means that gravity is a repulsive force. Well, what do you do then? How do you explain that? Well, other people have looked at this problem in the past, going back to Newton's time. And there was a colleague of Newton for some years, and he put forward the idea that gravity is a pushing in force. And where two bodies are close, they shield one another from the pushing force that way. And therefore, it looks like an attraction between them. And it works, you know, theoretically it works. However, they couldn't think of a mechanism. You know, how would you do that? What sort of things could push bodies together? And they were thinking in terms of particles smashing in, you know, at high speed from all directions. Well, that doesn't work, because you need to collide things together and release energy in the process, and the Earth would be vaporized by the energy required to reverse its direction around the sun in 6 months. Now, there's a colossal amount of energy involved in that. But if it's an electrical force which controls everything, then the answer is much more simple. But when you look at the other aspect, and that is that inside the Earth, all the positive poles are facing one another. And you know what happens when you try and push two poles of a magnet together that are the same. If they're strong magnets, you can't do it. So the interior of the Earth then is hollow, because any matter inside, floating inside, will be drawn, just like we are to the surface, they'll be drawn to the inside.
They'll be drawn out.
Yeah. Yes. And if there is an object inside there, the tendency would be, if it's slightly off center, it would go crashing into the inside.
So if we actually went inside, we'd be crashing. We would be going to the
outer. You'd be drawn to the inner surface of the sphere,
which is what we are to the outside. So you could have.
That's right. We're just like iron filings. You know how iron filings, they don't care whether it's a north pole or a south pole that you put to, they'll be drawn to either. Well, it's the same thing. We like iron filings on the surface of the Earth. We're drawn to it because we're within the sphere of influence of the Earth. Once you get outside the sphere of influence of the Earth, you're in the sphere of influence of the Sun. Once you get outside the solar system, you're in the sphere of influence of the galaxy, and so on and so on. So it all made sense, but I thought, how in the hell am I ever going to say anything about this? Because I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have to go into. I'm going to have to look into all the seismological records and all this kind of stuff. But it's like the prepared mind. Once you have an idea in your head, things come to you. And
that's all we have for today, folks. The second part of this interview will air next week, and we'll dive much more into what's going on at the conference and some of the amazing topics that they're going to be covering and what that means to the future of humanity as people start to explore what these theories are. And yeah, we have to get into more what these theories are in the labs, research facilities. If they're proving out, we have to take it seriously if we want to move forward. Now, if they're in the labs and they're not proving out, the equations aren't proving out, then good. You know, I don't say good, but good in the sense that we're learning something. But if they are, which everyone that I am talking to is saying they are, then it's time for real debate. It's time for growing up and taking this seriously and looking at the material so that we can move forward and not be so scared to control and to harbor what you already know and not move forward. We have to evolve. And so I'm excited that this information is getting out there. So please, if you want to listen to this again, go to my website at sarahwestall.com, and the second part will be up there soon as well. So if you miss it next week, you can get it there on my website. So everybody have an amazing day.